use the term creative agencies is that label.
Right.
And creative agencies have run the risk, some of it is, I think, believe self-inflicted, of being creative agencies and not business agencies. And marketing is becoming more and more about business and not about creating ads.
Marketing is dead. Long live marketing. My name is Atul Nath, and you're listening to the Control-Alt-Delete-Reboot Marketing Podcast, a toolkit podcast for anyone who is looking to connect with tomorrow's customers and build tomorrow's brands. Doing business today is like being tossed around inside a food processor. To stay relevant in this manic world and be future forward, I believe we've got to hit reboot for marketing as a whole. Through this podcast series, I'm hoping to put together a podcast toolkit for all of you based on my conversations with some of the best marketing brains in India. Well, actually, they are some of the best marketing brains from all over the world. Thanks for tuning into my podcast. Hope you enjoy this, and please do hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Today, I have Harish Vasudevan with me. Harish is the Asia-Pacific Geo Leader for Digital Marketing at IBM, based out of Bangalore, and prior to this has spent many years with Ogilvy and WPP in many different parts of the world, in India, Singapore, Beijing, and Nairobi. Welcome to my podcast, Harish, and thanks for chatting with me.
Great to be here, Atul.
How did you get into marketing? How did you get into this crazy world of building brands?
Just straight out of campus, I graduated out of Symbiosis in Pune. And in those days, advertising agencies didn't come to institutes like Symbiosis. So I applied to many agencies. My first job was with Clarion, where I worked for a year and a bit. And then I joined Ogilvy many, many, many moons ago. And since then, it's been like a drug, a clean drug. There's always been something new, something exciting. It keeps me going. There's always something new. You meet all kinds of characters and personalities on both sides of the fence, and it has not stopped. And Ogilvy has been very nice to me. So I was in different cities in India, and as you mentioned, they moved me to China, Singapore, and then Africa. So there's been no reason to get off that roller coaster, except when I wanted to come back to India.
Right.
And then I chose to leave advertising and move to what they call the client side.
And how would you kind of compare that?
It's very, firstly, the job that I do is not a typical client job, as in I'm not a client for any agency. I'm sure I'd be a terrible client for any agency. I'm not a typical client, but the one big thing that I note, I feel, is that in the agency life, you're always under some pressure of some sort. There's either a budget pressure or a deadline pressure or quality pressure, usually all three at the same time. And so that sort of keeps the adrenaline flowing and always trying to find ways to optimize those three. Plus, often clients come to you to solve a problem. So you're always focused on trying to create a solution to that problem. Whereas on the client side, A, you've got somebody else to find a solution to the problem, so you're not thinking so much about it. And there is not that continuous, in a sense, you can anticipate things that are happening a little better. So you don't have that continuous pressure that you have in the agency world. It's only when, I think what happens is clients try to solve the problems themselves. And when they don't find a good solution, that's when they call in the agency. So then when the agency gets pulled in for certain kind of problems, they already are on a short timeline to get things done.
Right. And so in your current role, are you working with the digital marketing agencies, or is it all in-house? How does it kind of work? What is the nature of the animal you're kind of dealing with?
It's a combination. Now? So we work with WPP for all our creative and media.
Sure.
We do a lot of design work in-house.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So we have, I think most clients now have some version of digital services internal. So we do quite a lot of the low-hanging fruit, relatively boring work in-house, things like emails, web page designs, and things like that we do in-house.
Mm-hmm.
The campaign-related work usually is done with an agency. And we have a lot of the analytics work is now done in-house by us. We use agencies very selectively in these cases because all the data sits on the client, client ends, all the website traffic, all of that. So huge investment in the analytics side of the business.
What are the areas that really have become either easier or more challenging or just different?
It's interesting. I think everybody's talked a lot about consumer is in control, speed of decision making, data, and all. I think all that's true. The way I try and look at it is using the classical four P's of marketing, and now people are saying five and six, but let's stick with four because that's relatively, everybody knows it.
Right.
We just look at the product side of business. I think what we're seeing is there are lots more new products and services now being available today that were inconceivable 20 years ago. So I talk about things like the usual things, like Ubers, Airbnbs, all of that stuff. It did not exist 20, 25 years ago. It were not possible 20, 25 years ago. You had the classical big brands. And because digital has arrived and technology has arrived, it is possible for new players to get in and basically upend the old folks. Mm.
That is the shocking thing in terms of its sheer disruption that's happening across.
Correct.
Across
and it
all
comes
categories.
From all comes from unlikely spaces, right? So Airbnb is disrupting the hotel business. Absolutely. Uber is disrupting the car business. They're not even in this. You would not call them the same industry, but they're upending. Even on the B2B side, now this whole software as a service did not exist 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So now you don't need to invest in buying $1 million software suit. You can just download what you need. So products, all kinds of proliferation of products. Then look at price. You don't need to. Now you can rent. You can pay as you go. There's almost every service today you can pay as you go. You don't have to invest. And the other day I was looking at buying some dog food for Jojo. And on Amazon, you can subscribe for dog food. So you don't have
really?
To go. You don't have to go every month and order. They just subscribe to it, and then they'll deliver it to you. Mm. So, pricing is, you know, your pricing model needs to factor in this whole way of people buying, and then advertising. Of course, I think there's enough written about advertising and how consumers are reacting. And I think this whole Singles Day sale that Alibaba does. I was reading that they created something like 25 or 30 million unique pieces of advertising, customized to AI-driven, customized to the...
Really?
Yes.
That's a crazy number.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
We need the big films, but when you are online, you need the quick response, customized to Atul, who is based in Noida, is a parent, all of that stuff.
Sure, sure. Do consumers want that?
Consumers don't know. See, the thing is, I see an ad that's customized to me, so I think it's great. And there's always this fine line. Like,
and consumers are happy with the data being,
it's a fine line between happiness and intrusion, right? So if you go, for example, I think everybody talks about the story. If you go online looking for a flight ticket, then the people are chasing you no matter where you go on the web. So sometimes you think it's interesting and you may find something that's useful, but so it's a fine line between how much information people have. And completely another in terms of customization, we have lots of visitors who come from around the world, and usually they stay at the Ritz-Carlton.
Right.
And the Ritz-Carlton is famous for its service. They recognize people come back, and then if you're, for example, I think you read stories of, if your shaving cream is finished, they'll put a new tube of shaving cream, toothpaste, all of that stuff. And one of our colleagues was talking about how she had come back from work to a hotel room, and the housekeeping lady had cleaned a hairbrush, had removed all the hair from the hairbrush. And so that's when, so till then, everybody was really happy with the customized service. This is when this client, this colleague,
crossed the line.
Was spooked, saying that, no, where is that line? So this whole customer service is how much, and in the offline world, you have the same issue. You go to a restaurant, a waiter who's over-friendly is interfering with your life. Mm. So it's a fine line on that.
Yeah, I mean, I know, I don't know who I was talking to the other day. I mean, being even as simple as personally addressed in airlines these days, right? I mean, Vistara does it. Jet used to do it when Jet was around. They would always have that little list of names with them and Mr. This and Mr. That. And I've always been actually happy with that. I'd never had a problem. But I was talking to someone the other day and they just didn't like it. They said that, you know, why is there a need to do that? Just give me my food and let's move on.
It's a personal thing. Folks. And that's the thing about data. Sometimes you want the data to be used.
Yeah.
The same person may like it, may not like it. And if some people don't want it at all. So it's very hard to...
At some level, Harish, I believe it's a matter of whether at the end of the day it delivers some value for me, which I otherwise would not have got. So, for example, you were talking about online that, you know, the air ticket that they keep following you kind of thing. If I believe that gets me something extra in terms of value, then I'm probably okay with it. Absolutely. I think it's a question of whether I got value out of it or not.
And I don't think today technology is the place where technology can predict that.
Mm.
It can't even predict whether you bought the ticket. Mm. All it knows is that you look for a trip to Delhi.
Absolutely.
It doesn't know whether you bought it. Mm. And then it doesn't know whether you need anything else. It's trying to sell you hotels.
Mm.
And it doesn't know whether you have a house or not. So this whole communication is changing. And I think everybody's talking, of course, of AI in communications. And there are brands who are doing AI with fashion and AI with music and all of that. So I think this whole communication piece is dramatically changed. And there's enough written about it and out there. And of course, distribution. So, you know, you don't need to have a shop. Many big brands don't have shops. You buy it online. And it's interesting, people like Amazon are now setting up stores. So I think
The reverse of it, the omnichannel and all that.
People are going to have, need both. Yep. Sometimes you're out on the street and you think you want something, whereas sometimes you're in the comfort of a house. So I think it's changing, just using these four filters, you can see a ton of change.
Do you see, given your experience across geographies, do you see a difference between India and some other parts of the world on this need for physical interaction and retail presence, or is it pretty much the same everywhere?
Some years ago, I was involved in a research we'd done on calls to action at the end of a campaign. So what do you like? And what we found is, I'm not talking, this is about a few years ago, it's not current, is that Indians preferred face-to-face was option one, phone was two, online was three.
Right.
And many of the developed markets were quite happy to just not talk to somebody, just deal with somebody online and not have anybody call them and meet them. So there are some cultural nuances where people prefer the relationship to take it going forward, and there are some who don't want. And
I have a feeling that's changing as well. You know, culturally, India's changing as well. I think maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe millennials are more, and I don't know, centennials are more comfortable with not necessarily needing that physical interaction. Which is part of
somebody
technology.
I trust. If I meet somebody, I trust that person. Mm. Whereas we are quite used to dealing with people who you never meet. Mm. And half the time, you don't ever meet. Even talking to somebody who's real, that could be a bot at the other end and
who's
engaging in a conversation with you. Mm. It reminds me, there was some time ago, there was a pop psychology that was done where people asked to find the code. There's a cow, dog, and grass.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm.
And you have to group them into two. Mm. Which two would you put together? And many parts of the world put cow and dog together because both animals.
Right.
And grass is obviously not.
Right.
And there's some parts of the world that put cow and grass together because cow eats grass.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole thing of those who put cow and grass together prioritize relationships over
interesting.
Just plain left brain things.
Right.
So
I wonder if anyone put dog and grass together. That would be
those people need special investigation.
Absolutely. They've got nothing to do with reality. So Harish, I'd like to talk a little bit about how organizations make buying decisions. You know, B2B and B2C are considered in many ways to be very different plays. Having said that, at the end of the day, people making decisions in B2B situations are also human beings and people. So how would you kind of, what are the nuances that you'd like to kind of highlight in B2B buying decision making?
I think what we're seeing in B2B is getting a little similar to B2C the way I look at it from an unexpected way, which is that there is a new group of influencers arriving in B2B decisions.
Okay, that's
interesting. And if I take the analogy of kids' food,
mm-hmm.
The person who's buying is the parent,
mm-hmm.
but you want to make sure that the kid is going
Absolutely.
To eat.
Absolutely.
So you check with the kid where the kid is going to eat, and sometimes the kid tells you, I want this, and then you do the check. If I just take that to B2B, there was a time when decisions were C-level people who took decisions, CIO, CTO, CFO, who you want, and they're the ones who sat in a boardroom and took a decision. That's changing a lot, largely because of what we discussed a little bit earlier about now the ability to access products and services which don't cost millions of dollars. And if I just take IT for an example.
Right. Absolutely.
Today, if a large company has got, and most large companies have developers in their organization.
Right.
And these are IT developers is who I'm referring to. They have access to free code. They download and they can work on it. They can run many small pilots in their little teams to solve a problem that they think the business has. And once that pilot is run and has reached some level of success, that's when they would, then it goes to a C-level saying, remember we had this problem, we've got this solution, it's already worked, now let's talk to the IT company relevant to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of big IT companies have recognized that this relationship only at the C-level is not enough anymore. You need to reach the people who are actually doing the work. And lots of big companies, the Salesforces, Microsofts, Amazons, they have strong IBMs, have strong developer relationships because that's where decisions now are getting made.
Strong influence there.
Strong influence. Right. And the buyer still, you still have to go to the board and all mm-hmm. of that. You still go through the usual process. But the people now who are involved in decision making is much larger and probably a different group from what it used to be earlier. And we're seeing this now across, I imagine, most categories that have got technology involved. This just changes dramatically happened over the last 5 or 10 years with the arrival of SaaS. And now you don't, so you need to manage both ends. It's different for marketing, B2B marketing. You typically used to be the CFO, that level is a person who decides and largely is based on price being a key decision maker and of course delivery and the brand.
Right.
But now it is a new bunch of people who are playing a very strong, active, influential role in how companies decide what they do. And we're seeing, and B2B buying is one thing, we're also seeing people, employees having points of view on companies' political stances, companies' decision making. So I suppose this arrival of what we call loosely millennials is kind of, using a terrible word, democratized decision making in a big way, and it's the control is much wider than it used
broadening.
To be. The flip side is that decisions happen quicker, as in the developer is not waiting for some approval from procurement to do something. She or he is downloading, going fast. And that's why we're seeing Agile come into big way in the organization. It's coming from obviously the software world where you have a solution that's likely to solve this problem. Now you can keep iterating as time goes by,
right.
But you need something that does something today.
Right, right. Tell me another thing. You mentioned somewhere in the middle, you mentioned the importance of brand. And that's another thing that was often highlighted as the big difference between B2B and B2C. Which is that B2C tends to be a much greater emphasis and a need for building brands. B2B a little less so. How do you see that? And then I just want you to kind of connect that with the marketing communication piece, because obviously you're probably not going to use a lot of ATL mass media kind of advertising for B2B marketing. So what has been your experience in what works in marketing communication terms for B2B marketing?
Yeah, so the importance of what does a brand do? Brand is a sign of trust.
Mm-hmm.
So for no matter which, whether you're in B2B or B2C, in B2B, the brand ironically is a little more important because you're spending the future of the company is going to rest in the decision that you make.
Mm.
So it's important that whoever the company decides to partner with has got the ability to deliver what the person is being promised. So then the power of the company that comes from the brand becomes important. Because if you look at the SaaS companies, there are hundreds and thousands of SaaS companies. Almost everybody is offering you some solution or the other. So how do you decide? And the brand becomes a shortcut to take the decision on what you want to do.
Right.
Whereas in the B2C space, we've always been used to brands, but there's also a high barrier to entry. Not everybody can make a toothpaste. There's also a high barrier to entry in B2C. So in a sense, the brands that are operating there's a clutch of brands in many categories. Whereas in B2B today, anybody can be a travel agency, anybody can be a ticketing company, anybody can be anything. So there is a wider choice. So then the shortcut is the brand. The flip side is because barrier to entry is low, it is possible that a new person comes and completely upends the existing, like exactly like what Salesforce did to the whole CRM space.
Slack.
Slack is doing, example, and yeah. somebody else is going to come tomorrow and yeah. change what Absolutely. Slack is up to. So the power, the brand is going to be important, and I think there are in the B2B space the opportunity to build a brand, let me call it bottom up, is as equally strong as building it top down. That's what I mean is that in the B2C space, the classical way to build a brand is advertising.
Right.
You advertise, advertise, advertise.
Right.
In the B2B space, you have the possibility of building the brand through people using.
Interesting.
You download, okay. talked about Slack, right? I haven't seen a campaign for Slack. So you download Slack, you use Slack, then you tell somebody else, and then slowly everybody knows using Slack and the brand is built. So it's a very so you can build and many
organic growth. If
many
you can
B2B
call it
brands
that, yeah.
actually Salesforce, all many of these brands have built their brands organically. And many years ago, talking again slightly in the B2C space, the only example I know is Asus laptops. They build their brands entirely through distribution. Any computer outlet you went to, there was Asus laptops available. And then you saw the brand everywhere, and that's how they built their brand.
And they hadn't really built it
top-down
No, top-down at all.
So B2B, the brand continues to be important. I don't think the brand importance will go away. In the B2C space, however, is where I see some erosion of, potential erosion of brands, because I can, the cost of experimenting has come down a lot. Cost of making choices, like I was on Big Basket 2 days ago doing some grocery shopping, and I wanted to buy, I forget what it was, and it was not in stock, but they said, do you want something else? And I flipped brand just because there's something else available, and I needed to complete my shopping then. So it's interesting. I think
which is similar to what may have happened to you if you were in the store.
A grocery store. Yeah, absolutely.
But it's so much easier for the brand to do
in a
digital situation, because obviously there's no physical effort required to put products on the
But here you're trusting the Big Basket brand. You're saying if Big Basket is recommending, then it's probably a good brand. Even if it's a brand they did not really heard of. So I think that's where we are seeing the power of Amazon and these people.
So you'd say, and to go further into a little bit on the marketing communication, is it mostly digital marketing which works on B2B? Is it online? I mean, online in the sense that it's social media, LinkedIn. What is the kind of, I just want to go deeper for listeners to actually get some very actionable thing, whatever is in your opinion kind of works for B2B.
I think the importance of above the line advertising cannot be understated for B2B. There still is a place for above the brand advertising for, because you've got multiple stakeholders. Your customers is one bit of stakeholders. You've got potential employees who want to work with companies that they've heard of.
Right.
Even clients, they want to know what does your brand do. Because your digital communication tends to be very transactional. Buy this software, buy this hardware, buy this service. But what does your brand stand for? What is your bigger mission in life? So that's where the role of advertising comes in. You're trying to create an emotional connect to the brand, and you do most of the rational stuff through the more transactional kind of advertising. So I think most big brands are advertise above the line on television or any such medium, but they play the classical selling of a product or a service actually happens through the digital space. And the other thing is it's long drawn, right? Because these decisions take 3 to 6 months for a person to arrive at deciding to buy a new software. Because I started with learning.
Right.
Now everybody's talking about quantum. So what the hell is quantum? So there's a whole process of learning, then deciding does quantum work for you or not, then running a pilot, then calling people. That whole education phase is all done. Digital works best for that. So lots of content created, drive people to the content. We do a lot of events. Most B2B companies do a lot of events. That's where you actually go and meet people. You meet clients who've done stuff.
Sure.
So that's easily 3 to 6 month period.
Yeah, and that brings us back to the meeting people to create relationships, because relationships are so important in in building the brand.
That's one. Second is my situation may not be exactly the same as your situation. So I need somebody to explain that, yes, I am in a bank like that bank, but my bank has got A, B, C, D, and then you need somebody to understand that for you. So no two solutions are kind of the same either. They are customized for, they need to be kind of tweaked for the client.
Harish, let me just ask you about your views, how should I put this, pragmatic or emotional, on the importance of data in marketing and how, you know, the consumer is kind of being influenced by marketers or brand owners in this using data.
Well, I guess you must have heard that data is important.
Of course, it's crucial. There's no data, there's nothing. There are if rumors. It can't be tabulated, it's not important.
There are rumors that data exists. So, yeah, I think one of the... So this is a double-edged sword. With sure. digital, everything is tracked, measured. And because it is tracked and measured, everybody's tracking and measuring everything else. But then finally, what I think the pendulum obviously swung to the other extreme of using data for every single thing. And the creativity part, I'm using creativity very loosely, mm-hmm. is sort of being is kind of being left behind.
Okay.
And now people are, I think, having to make choices between do I want to do creative work or do I want to do data-driven work. And I think that's sort of a false choice to my mind. I think data is very good at dissecting problems.
Mm-hmm.
Data tells you what happened.
But many people are using it for much more than that. And
yes,
that may be where the problem is.
And there is some bit of what to look at going forward. So if you look at, if you defeated data analysis, we would never have got the iPhone.
Right.
With the deadness, we never had the car industry.
Right.
That happened by somebody bringing creativity, looking at history and putting
Absolutely.
Creativity into it.
Absolutely.
And I saw there's a TED talk, I think it was in TED Canada or something, where a guy talked about how Netflix uses data. They use data to break down, and then they give it to a bunch of creative people to put it back together. And create a new picture.
Mm.
So they don't use data to create new pictures. We've seen IBM did a partnership with a DJ in the UK.
Okay.
And they used AI to create a Billboard Top 10 song. So AI gave him all the inputs. But finally, the human is a guy who put it together to create it into a music track that ended up in being well. So I think AI, you can look at N minus 1, and AI can predict what N plus 1 can be. But it'll always be N plus 1. If you want to N plus infinity, that's where the human element gets in to say this is the creative twist to what that can be. So there are some things which AI is very good at, and obviously you should use, data is good at, you should use data for it. But relying entirely on data is kind of relying entirely on what the consumer has said in the past and what consumer is thinking to make a future decision. So I think the leap that you want to make in the step changes are more likely to happen through human interpretation of data than by relying on data 100%.
And in your knowledge and experience, are marketers kind of doing this, or are they going over the edge and kind of focusing on data alone?
No, I think many marketers are running pilots in different parts of the world using data, AI to see how it can help them in consumer decision making, in communication,
right.
even in product design. So
there are
pilots that are happening in different parts of the world on the creative side of it. And they're pilots. I think, as I said, relying entirely on data. What is that line about relying on research like a crutch or a lamppost or something like that? So use the data. There is data. Use it. But relying on data for every single thing. One of the challenges in digital is trying to link everything to clicks and click-throughs. And the value of the impression is zero.
Yeah.
Nobody cares whether the person saw the ad or not. Did the person click? Whereas on television, we are quite willing to spend millions of dollars for people just to see ads without them doing anything. So the ability of us to saying there is a value in somebody experiencing something, even if the person actually don't actually do something, needs to come back into data.
Yeah. And even structurally, I mean, I'm sure you've been reading about a lot of these creative agencies being kind of taken over by consulting businesses and things like that. I don't know what that will do to creative agencies. I mean, many of them are also not, but... And I just see it as, you know, everything is not a trend. There's always a mix in this process. So,
I think one of the things that has happened, I feel has happened with the use of the term creative agencies is that label.
Right.
And creative agencies have run the risk, some of it is, I think, believe self-inflicted, of being creative agencies and not business agencies. And marketing is becoming more and more about business and not about creating ads.
Mm.
I remember many, many years ago, talking to a brand manager in Levi's, I'm talking 20 years ago.
Right.
He asked the agency folks, how much time do you think me as a brand manager spends on advertising related matters? From the agency side, all the estimates are 50% and above. From the brand manager, he said, I spend 10 to 12% on advertising. So at that point in time, that's the amount of time a brand manager spent thinking about advertising.
The rest is business.
It's about business. So I think those people who are able to, I'm not saying creative is not important. You need creative to solve a business problem. But if it's creative is about, like, here's a television commercial or a digital campaign, whatever it is, then you're not talking to the people who decide.
Yeah, like you just said, creative is supposed to solve a business problem. So the business is important. And very often creative agencies, very often, not always, are not really focused on the fact that the creative is supposed to solve a business problem.
Correct.
So the then creative for the creative exists.
So then you don't get share of mind of CMOs of companies or CEOs of companies. I don't know how many agencies are actually talking to, are able to get into CEOs. That's when consulting companies get in.
Right.
Because data is important.
Right.
Digital
is
important.
Sure.
A lot of it is about transformation. They're already talking to C-level executives.
Yeah.
Then the creative becomes like an also-ran.
Okay, on that very hopeful note for agencies as well as for brands, you know, it's been great fun chatting about some serious marketing stuff. So let's have some fun. I'm going to just ask you a few quick questions and you can just give me your immediate response. I hate calling it the rapid fire round because I'm not Karan Johar. Okay, in your opinion, the best movie ever made?
I think Pulp Fiction. It's a movie that I can watch anytime, every time. Yeah.
Okay, great. Your favorite three songs?
Interesting. Favorite
ever.
Three songs. That's
no pressure, huh?
No, no. There's no such thing as... So there's a category called favorite to have thousands of songs.
Right.
So that, but there are three songs I don't mind listening to almost any time, and it's completely an eclectic mix, I think. The first is Gangster's Paradise by Coolio.
Mm.
It's a bit despondent, but I enjoy the song. The second is Brothers in Arms. Dire Straits.
The song, not the album.
The song, specifically. And the third is completely left field, I think. A song by a guy called T.M. Krishna.
Okay.
So something called Notaswaram. I heard him sing it at my brother-in-law's son, so my nephew's wedding.
Achha.
And it's the first time I heard it, and first time I heard him. But then I've sought that song and hear it. It's sort of a These are my three sort of songs that I listen to.
I have not heard that one, so I'll have to find that somewhere.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah. Okay, super. Your favorite place to think big, where you get ideas?
In the shower.
In the shower.
Yes.
Okay, that's one of mine as well. Okay, if you hadn't built your career in marketing, advertising, communication, whatever you want to call it, what do you think you would have done?
I don't know if I would have, but my dream is to be a comedian.
Okay, still could happen.
To write, yeah.
Still could happen.
Some people may think dream achieved.
No, the thing is that comedians have no age. So,
yeah,
you know, so you can start it at any age.
So stand-up comedy is my goal.
Super. Okay, an object from your childhood that you wouldn't throw away?
It's interesting. A few years ago, we were clearing, maybe 2 years ago, we were going through some old photo albums and my daughter saw a photo of me and said, my dad had hair, so I think that photo is something I'll never throw away.
You can be a comedian, for sure. One thing you wish your phone could do, which it can't.
Two things.
Mm-hmm.
One very prosaic,
mm-hmm.
and one I think we all need. The prosaic one is being able to enable out of office on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
On people, when people call you and WhatsApp you.
Right.
So if you're not in town, the phone tells the person he's not in town, they still want to continue the call.
Right.
So I think a lot of calls would go away and people aren't expecting a response in WhatsApp messages and stuff.
Mm.
That's the prosaic one.
Mm-hmm.
The valuable one is an AI-infused phone that will automatically mute people who talk nonsense, especially on conference calls. You always have somebody who's talking for hours.
Absolutely.
And so if the phone has got AI into it, so it has already read all the research. And says, because the guy's talking nonsense, it just kind of mutes the person or says something like that, I think.
That would be a good one. I'm sure a lot of people would pay big money for that one.
Okay, that's what I'm going to develop now.
That's a good idea, yeah, okay. Your favorite app on your phone?
Oh, the favorite app on my phone actually is, I'm very sad, it's email.
Email, okay.
Very sad.
All right. For the benefit of all our listeners, anything you'd like to recommend? Something you've read or watched? It doesn't have to be work-related, business-related, marketing-related. It could be just something fun like the movie you're planning to watch or anything.
Yeah,
whatever.
Yeah. So I just finished reading Elton John's autobiography.
Ah, okay.
Quite remarkable in terms of, and he's been pretty open and honest about all the stuff that he went through.
Right.
It's a great read. It's quite funny. I did not realize that he was a funny guy. But it does also good funny stories about his life. And it's a remarkable life of how a guy who's not even called Elton John became this big star and all his challenges with drugs and being gay and Lady Diana and all of that. So that's definitely something that I think people would enjoy. The other book that I was just talking to you about earlier was this book by Jay Epstein on the Hollywood industry, on how films are made. It's about the business of Hollywood.
Right.
And that's when you realize that how much left brain thinking goes into the biggest right brain industry in the world.
Creative, the biggest creative industry, so to speak.
And it's very prosaic. He said, at the end of the day, the most important thing is, will the actor be insured or not? He said, actors are not insured, nobody's going to make the film. And so he talks about when Tom Cruise says, I did my own stunts, and somebody says, these are all lies. Because not a single person is allowed to do their own stunts. Once you're insured, the insurance company puts a person on set. And that person has to say, yes, the person can do act or not. Anything. And he talks about, I think it was Nicole Kidman, because she injured her knee, she's struggling to get insurance for her next film. She had to pony up the money for herself from her own side to get her insurance cover so she could make the next film.
Right.
So quite interesting. So that's another book. I read 2 to 3 books a week, so I can go on talking about books a lot.
Yeah.
Then a book called Remnant.
2 to 3 books a week?
Yeah. I don't do podcasts.
That's pretty prolific. No, really? That's amazing.
The Remnants of a Separation, I think, by Anchal Malhotra, which, again, you read about the partition, but they didn't... She talks the story of partition through the objects people brought with them when they moved. And so people brought clothes and vessels, and many people came thinking that they would go back. So they brought literally the essentials, and then she went and found these people on both sides of the border and what they took with them. It's a great story of humanizing partition with actually the people and what they... That there is a trauma, but you left home with the shawl. The shawl is the most important thing for you in the story. And the shawl. So a couple of books that I think I found interesting.
Okay, great. A couple of recommendations I have. One is a book called Ikigai. I don't know if you've read that by Hector Garcia and Francesc Miralles. A simple book with very simple message about how to live your life for a longer life.
Okay.
And it's based on... these people, Japanese, obviously. Ikigai is a very Japanese concept. And it's a small town called Okinawa. Not small town, but a medium-sized town. And how they have the highest average age in terms of longevity.
Okay.
And because of the way they live their lives and, the importance they give to certain things in life. And it's very interesting. And one of my favorites that I'm trying to do every day now is that most people in that town believe that you should stop eating when you're 75% full.
Okay.
Right? So don't eat till you're full, but eat till you're 75% full, because that then, keeps you kind of healthy in terms of what you're eating and so on.
Yeah, I've heard this. This guy called Lee Kuan Yew was his prime minister of
Singapore.
He also says his percentage was 80%.
Okay.
So I think
maybe it was 80%.
I think we need some data driven.
Could be. Yeah. Yeah. The other is a TV series called Succession, which is on Hotstar, what I love about that series is that, none of the characters are black and white. They all have grays. There's good about them. There's bad about them, which is the way life is anyway, right? So
I tried watching that and I stopped watching only because of it. It's too graphic at some point in time.
It is. It is.
And then I like my characters black and white.
Oh, okay.
All right. Let me tell you a TV show that you may have seen heard of called Barry. Have you heard this?
No.
It's
what's it called? Barry.
Barry. It's on Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's this Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
He's an assassin who wants to be an actor.
Oh, okay.
So that's season one is done. So he joins acting class and he's also killing people on the side. So definitely season two is just out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Another one I saw, I think it was on Netflix, was this one called Mossad 101. We were talking about acting in classes and stuff. It was basically about a set of trainees who joined the Mossad and their experiences. And part of it is funny. Part of it is intense.
I just started watching Messiah. Have you heard of Messiah?
I saw it, but I haven't read it.
I just saw one episode and then I have to consult with my wife whether I can watch it by myself.
Or it's a family activity. Yeah. We keep figuring that out as well. Okay, Harish, thanks a lot for your time. It's been great fun and learning talking to you. Okay, so that's a wrap for this episode. You can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, or any other podcast platform that you use. See you next time with another exciting guest from the marketing world.